So, welcome for Computer Graphics. Today we will speak about virtual reality. And yeah, you see, we also prepared a little demo. Probably most of you have already seen how these things work or what it looks like. But nevertheless, I think it's a good idea to show them again and to also a little bit go into details. What is really needed for that technology, and also what is the graphics stuff behind that. So today we will speak about virtual reality, and in fact virtual reality is a very large area, and these headsets here, these head-mounted display, are only a small subcategory. They have been rather popular in the last years, but in fact virtual reality can be delivered by very different devices, but today we will only speak about these particular head-mounted displays. Yeah. Okay, so up to now, when we spoke about graphics, we always thought about a setup, or we were mostly considering a setup that we have something like a desktop computer with a screen. It has a nice GPU built in, and the screen has a refresh rate of maybe 60 hertz. That means it generates 60 new images per second. And this is about, if we want to do interactive graphics with moving objects and so on, this is the frame rate we are targeting, that we generate an image every 60th second. And then this gives us a smooth animation on the screen. What we will look into today are mobile displays. Very often our display is not fixed on a desk, but we can wear it and we can carry it around, or at least drive it around like in a navigation system. But what we want to consider today is more devices like a mobile phone that we can carry around and do augmented reality. I will also speak about that briefly, or these head-mounted displays. So these are displays that you can wear on your head. And there's not only the difference that the display is maybe smaller and closer to your eyes, but the device itself is aware of its position. It is being tracked. So if you move around, it knows about this movement and can adapt the view accordingly. And of course that has interesting consequences. So for instance, with such a head-mounted display, it's possible that you look around and the camera view is automatically adapted by moving your head. You don't need a mouse or something like that to rotate your camera. You do that intuitively by moving the head or by even walking around. And this is a very different experience from looking at a scene on a screen, and it has interesting technical challenges that we will speak about today. Although these head-mounted displays, as we know them today, are not too old, in fact, the idea for having head-mounted displays is very old. And in fact, we will see in a minute in a video that it's already more than 50 years old. Here we see another rather old version of a head-mounted display. You see it, it's more a box, it's not as fancy as these devices look today. And the major challenge at that time was that there were no LCD panels. The only way to display an image with a computer were CRT tubes, these big TVs, that were very deep and very heavy. And now the challenge was to get two such devices into two such tube displays into a box. They produce a lot of heat, and so forth. So that was a major problem. Which made it sort of unusable for a long time. Very heavy, and so forth. But at least people could see that. That might be cool. If once the technology is far enough that we have good resolution, that they are lighter, and so on, that might really work out well. Furthermore, it was clear that there are new challenges. So, for instance, one challenge is, how to control your application. Yeah, if you're wearing such a device, you're completely locked off from the environment. Yeah, you only see your virtual world. So it's already very difficult to find a key on the keyboard, yeah, because you don't see your real environment anymore. So it's also a challenge how to generate controllers or devices that help you in VR also to control. In general, the environment is locked off. Yeah, so people have to get used to walking around, yeah, and not always being afraid to walk against the wall or something like that. Nevertheless, the technology was interesting, and there was a device, a variant of head-mounted displays called a Boom. And here you can see how that looks like. And here the idea is that this is not really head-mounted, but it's a display or two displays, and you look into them, yeah, like into glasses sort of, but because that's so heavy, it is mounted to a boom, and that can be controlled easily. Yeah, so you look into that usually with two handles. Yeah, and then you can move around, and also the position is tracked by devices in that boom that measure angles, and from that the position can be recomputed. Yeah, so that's another advantage, that the tracking in that case is rather simple. Yeah, because there's always a physical connection between the head-mounted display and some basis station. okay, so that was a practical approach, but of course, yeah, it would be much better if your hands are free and you can move around freely. But nevertheless, yeah, it was an interesting step. But nevertheless, I said, this technology is rather old, and it already, so the first system that was presented in that direction was from Ivan Sutherland in 1968, and he already introduced something like such a head-mounted display, and here we see a video, so please excuse the poor quality, and what you can see is that, so first of all, he's here wearing these glasses. In fact, the image comes from these two tubes on the side, yeah, that had to be held by hands, yeah, because they were rather heavy. And the image was then shown to the eyes using mirrors. And in fact, these mirrors were only partially reflective. That means you can also see the environment. Yeah, that's what we today call augmented reality. So you do not only see the virtual content, but also the surrounding. And what you can also see is that there is a device on top here, which is responsible for tracking. So when he moves around, this thing has a long arm, yeah, with multiple joints that are mounted to the ceiling. And by measuring the angles, the position can be tracked. He also even has another variant that has a tracking using ultrasound, which gives more freedom in moving around. Yeah, but that video here is done with a physical measurement for the tracking, and the entire thing then looks like this. Maybe I turn off the light. Yeah, so he can walk around and look around, and the graphics at that time that was possible was showing a wireframe cube, yeah, and you can see that it also tracks the head, it adapts the rendering of that cube so that it looks like that cube would, yeah, stand in front of the viewer. I mean, you cannot see it that well here from the video, but all components essentially are there that we have in these head-mounted displays today, yeah, and that was in 1968, so really a long time ago. Okay, here we see it again. Looks a little bit frightening, but it worked. Okay, and as I said, yeah, these devices were transparent, so you can still see your surrounding, And that's a major difference from these here. And usually this is described as, this we describe as virtual reality headsets, because you really only see your virtual environment. You're completely locked off the rest of your scene. And in these other augmented reality displays, yeah, the display is transparent, so you can still see the environment. And also this, yeah, obviously is not very new. Also military found that very interesting, yeah, as so often that military is one of the first users of such systems. So here you can see a helmet with such a display that should display some whatever important information to the soldier, and nevertheless he or she can still see the surrounding. Google tried something similar with the Google Glasses. Yeah, probably heard of that. Essentially, the project was not a success. And I think they are still working on it, but obviously try a redesign. And here we have another device, which is the Microsoft HoloLens. This is the first version. A new version is coming now. And this is a really rather sophisticated device already, also for augmented reality with lots of tracking stuff and so on, several cameras on board, rather heavy. Yeah, so I mean it's wearable, but still rather heavy. But things advance in this direction. Yeah. Okay, but for now we want to look at virtual reality. Yeah, many problems of virtual reality then also simply transfer to augmented reality, and probably you all know these glasses, the different variants that are available. Oculus was one of the first companies that built them at a larger scale, have then quickly been bought by Facebook. So today it's a company that belongs to Facebook. And the development of the Oculus was mainly driven by two developments. The first one was that with mobile phones, small light displays were available and cheap, yeah. And this is the basis, one of the major problems of old HMDs, yeah, that these displays were very heavy. But with LCD panels and the cheap prices for these panels, because they are sold million-wise in mobile phones, yeah, the display technology was there. And another thing was that you always need a tracking for these devices, yeah, so that you can follow head movement. And there were also big advances in this technology. Yeah, so tiny little sensors, as you also know them from your mobile phone, yeah, that decide whether you're in landscape mode or in portrait mode, for instance. Yeah, these are small little sensors that measure movement, or that you can make actions by shaking your mobile phone, for instance. Yeah. These are tiny little sensors, and they became more and more available, and they are also required for these. Yeah, and this opened the door to generate such head-mounted displays now at affordable prices. Yeah, not only for research institutions, but really for a big market. And the technology is always, I mean, there are many advances in this direction, but the design is essentially always the same. We have that small display. We have two lenses, yeah, because the display is so close, yeah, that you are simply not able to focus to that very, very close display. So lenses are needed that virtually move the display to a comfortable distance, something like 2 meters, yeah, so you can see the screen clearly. And simply by construction, the left eye only sees the left half of the screen and the right eye sees the right half of the screen. Yeah, so they see separate areas on the screen, so you can deliver separate images to the two eyes. And this is one of the requirements to make stereo rendering. And we will come back to that. Yeah, and additionally, they have several position sensors, yeah, that measure position, rotation, and stuff like that. And yeah, this is something about which we will speak next week then. Okay, and then there are a number of successors. That list already, again, is outdated. Like the HTC Vive, that's this one here. And several others. Yeah, Google came up with a version where you can simply take a cardboard and fold your headset and just insert a mobile phone. Yeah, because a mobile phone has all the components you need essentially. Yeah, it has the display and it has these position sensors, so you can run a VR application also on a phone, and you just need something to put the phone in front of your eyes and also two lenses so that you can focus to the display from that short distance. Yeah, and then you're done. But of course, the quality is not comparable to what you get with these other devices. Okay, so that's the general idea. Yeah, and in today, we will look into two details of that technology. First of all, we will look into lens distortion. These lenses, usually because they are so close to the display, result in strong distortions that somehow have to be corrected. And we will more generally look into stereo rendering. How do we set up the matrices so that we get correct stereo images? And more generally, we will look into depth perception. Yeah, how can we improve depth perception in such an HMD? And next lecture is not okay. Yeah, and then in another lecture, we will speak about tracking and latency. These are also two interesting technical challenges of this technology. Okay, maybe that's a good point to show a little demo so that you have a maybe better understanding of what's going on there. And to this end, I will switch that off. And change to here, and I hope it works, it does. So what we here see is a little demo that we have built for the Lange Nacht der Wissenschaften recently. This is together with historians who have built that Roman boat. Probably you read about that or heard about that in the media. Yeah, that's a rather popular project of our university students. Have rebuilt a boat as Romans used them to travel and to ship their troops through their empire. Yeah, and this build was rebuilt. We made a 3D scan of that boat that you can see here, so you can now virtually visit that boat. And now I take this display into my hands, and what you can already see is that the image is moving. Yeah, and if I rotate my head, yeah, the camera is moving accordingly, but it does not only measure rotation but also movement. Yeah, and the tracking happens by sensors here on the HMD, and there's this one particular device here that is also responsible for tracking, and which we will also learn about in a follow-up lecture. Yeah, and you see it's pretty fast. That's very important. Yeah, so when the head is moving, the image should adapt as fast as possible. For that reason, these displays have a rather high frame rate, something like 100 hertz, usually faster than a normal screen. And the reason is that if there is a significant lag between real movement and the movement of the image, then this results in uncomfort for the viewer. Yeah, people simply get motion sick. And many people wearing these glasses suffer from these problems. Others don't have problems, but several people really have problems with that. And the only way out is to try to reduce that time as much as possible. This requires, yeah, fast technology, but also fast algorithms. This is also something which we will speak about soon in the lecture. Yeah, so that the time between a change of the direction, in particular of the headset, to showing that change is as small as possible. Okay, I can now maybe briefly set it up. Okay, so, okay, that one is off. Turned off while I was speaking. Hey. Ah, okay. Yeah. Okay. Now you can also see the controller. Can you see it? Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Yeah. You can see that controller. Obviously, that controller is also tracked. Yeah. And in fact, it's really, I mean, yeah, I can put it here on the table and it's, yeah, exactly at the right position. So I can really grab it, yeah, without seeing it. Yeah. It's virtual. Twin is absolutely at the right position. Okay, and you also see, yeah, that if I move my head, the camera angle changes, and for me it looks like this boat is here virtually fixed, yeah, and I can look around. Sometimes the tracking gets lost because we only have one of these tracking stations here, yeah, so, but if I look into this direction, that's fine. Yeah, and we can see quite some things. So one issue, for instance, if you look, I hope you can see it. Yeah, I hope you can see it. For instance, here for the leaves, yeah, they are flickering quite a lot. And this is simply because the position of that headset, the measured position, of course, is always chittering slightly. Yeah, so the camera is always slightly shaking. And for such leaves, then these flickering, these aliasing artifacts become rather prominent. Yeah, but otherwise it's a nice, interesting experience. I can move around using these controllers. The problem is that the area here, of course, is too small that I cannot really go everywhere. But I can beam. Ooh, okay, that was not good. Even worse. Okay, let me get out here. Okay, yeah, also an interesting perspective. Yeah, of course, everybody wants to know what's, okay, that's boring. Obviously, yeah, you remember what happens here? Backface culling, yeah, the surface, the water surface is only to be viewed from the top. Yeah, as soon as we are underneath, yeah, it disappears. Yeah, so that's backface culling. Okay. Now let's go here again. Yeah, I can see that boat. Ooh. Yes, after some time you really, yeah, lose your view direction. Yeah, and it's, I mean, okay, these are all artifacts, yeah, from the 3D reconstruction. That's interesting how that happens. Yeah, but it's there. There's another thing, the origin for that boat is our findings, okay, I don't know the English word, from a moor close to Ingolstadt or Manching. So they found remainings of such a boat, yeah, and these you can see here. Yeah, we also did a 3D scan from these. Yeah, the rebuild sort of, yeah, uses this basis, or at least the shape of this basis, and then built the entire boat on top. I really don't know anymore where I am. Ah, okay, so I have to look into this direction. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so I hope this gives you a little impression of how that works and why that's interesting. And And this is what we are aiming for. So I'm pretty sure most of you have already used such a device. In case you haven't, simply ask after the lecture, then you can try it out. Yeah, it's an interesting experience. Okay. So, what do we need? One thing that we need, I already mentioned it a few times, are these lenses. So, the display is very close. Yeah, it's just here behind the lid. And normally, at that short distance, yeah, nobody's able to accommodate to that very close display. Yeah, so you need a lens, yeah, something like a magnifying glass, so that we see the display sharply. And these lenses need to be rather strong, yeah, because it's that very short distance only. And they also have another, or they are designed not only to see the display sharply, but also to increase the field of view. That means, yeah, if you look from these glasses from that direction, it's only this half here of the display is responsible for the image of the right eye, and the eye is maybe here, so the display is rather small. Yeah, if there would be no lenses, we would see the display under maybe this angle, which is rather small and not sufficient to get immersion. Yeah, if you only look through, or if you only see the world, yeah, in a rather small area. Having a large field of view and really also seeing things in the periphery is very important to have a high immersion. And to increase that, or these lenses, yeah, can also be used to increase that, yeah, because light rays are bent by the lens from the position of the eye. Yeah, this is the field of view here. Whereas the display, yeah, if we would only have the field of view of the display, that would be smaller. Yeah, so the lens both moves the focus of the display so that we can accommodate, and it increases the field of view. And now there are two variants to use that. The first one are so-called thick lenses. Yeah, and I mean, the reason why they are called thick lenses is obvious. Yeah, they are thick. And as a result, they also generate a very strong distortion in the image. Yeah, and they are also heavy, yeah, just because they are glass, yeah, which is not very light. So they can also significantly contribute to the weight. An alternative are so-called Fresnel lenses, yeah, and Fresnel had the idea that instead of using such a thick lens, yeah, so that's one of these lenses, yeah, the cross section looks like that, and he observed that only the shape of the surface, the local curvature, is responsible for the magnifying effect, yeah, and this can also be achieved, yeah, by using such a shape here, yeah, where at every point the local shape is exactly the same, but there are these rings here, or these positions, yeah, where the surface has a discontinuity. Yeah, but locally the shape is the same, and so the effect of these two lenses are very similar. But yeah, the lenses are flat, distortion is less, and they are lighter. Yeah, so it seems like they only have advantages. The disadvantage is that these rings here, these discontinuities, are usually still visible. And in particular, if there are light regions in our images, yeah, you can see rays going out from there. And in the periphery also, yeah, still see these rings a little bit. Yeah. So, yeah, both approaches are possible. But both, and in particular thick lenses, generate such a distortion here. Yeah, so yeah, it looks like you look through a magnifying glass or through the bottom of a bottle. Yeah, and These distortions can be described rather easily. They are called so-called barrel distortions, like this here. This is a barrel distortion, yeah, because it looks like the pattern of a barrel. And this is a pincushion distortion, yeah, because yeah, it looks like a pincushion, obviously. Yeah, and this distortion has to be corrected somehow, yeah, because people would feel bad if you look through in a virtual environment, yeah, and everything is bent and distorted this way. That's not a good idea. But these distortions can be described mathematically quite easily. It's a well-known effect. In fact, every camera or every lens of a camera has this effect. It's just the better the camera, the small, or the better the lens, the smaller this effect. But every camera has this effect, and so it's pretty well understood how to correct it and how to describe it in particular. And to describe it, what is usually done is that for every pixel, so let's say this is our image, yeah, that we want to display. Now we take a coordinate system that has the origin in the center of the image. Yeah, the center of the image is exactly the point where the lens is thickest. Yeah, that's the center of our image for now. And obviously the distortion is rotationally symmetric around that center, yeah, because the lens is normally rotationally symmetric, unless it's a very special progressive lens or something like that, yeah, but we have a normal symmetric lens. So obviously what we can do is that we compute polar coordinates of a point here in the image, yeah. So if we want to look at the distortion of such a point, we compute its polar coordinates, and now the distortion does not depend on the angle, yeah, because it's rotationally symmetric, but only on the distance. So we take polar coordinates, radius r and angle phi, and then we apply some distortion function on the radius. Yeah, this function is d of r, and this function depends on the lens. Yeah, and it can be rather well described using a polynomial. That's the so-called Brown's distortion model, and it uses a polynomial with even degrees. Yeah, so here you can see usually this form only up to r to the fourth is used. Yeah, so we have this very simple polynomial, and kr and k2 control the distortion. Yeah, so these are the two parameters that can freely be chosen to determine the distortion of that image. Yeah, and kr and k2 describe this function d of r, and this d of r is then used as a multiplier onto r. Yeah, so r is multiplied with that function. If k1 and k2 are zero, then d of r is one, and we have no distortion. Yeah, and then with k1 and k2, we can choose how this distortion works. And if coefficients are negative and d of r becomes smaller than one, we get a pincushion distortion, and otherwise we get such a barrel distortion. And yeah, so this model turns out to be practical for most types of lenses. Two coefficients, k1 and k2 are usually enough. And now in general, it's the case that these HMD lenses generate a pincushion distortion. Yeah, so in the way that they are built into the system. And this has the advantage that it increases resolution in the center of the image, yeah, because it squeezes things a little bit towards the center, yeah. Then resolution is increased at the center of the image, where it's more important, yeah. And then it has to be undistorted by using a corresponding barrel distortion, yeah. And so that we see an undistorted image, yeah, but have all the advantages of the lens. See it at the right focus, and also have a larger field of view. Yeah, so we need such an image undistortion. And in fact, that's a barrel distortion. And how that barrel distortion looks like or has to look like depends on the device and on the lens. And in fact, it even depends on very strongly how this lens is built in. It's not the same for every HMD. Yeah, every lens has slightly different parameters required to do a proper undistortion. And most often these parameters are measured when the device has been built and then are shipped together with the device in a configuration file or something like that. So that there's a per device good calibration or perfect calibration as you wish. Okay, so now we know how this undistortion function looks like, but how can we do the undistortion? Yeah, when we now render our views. Yeah. So if we go back now to computer graphics pipeline, for instance, or to a computer graphics application, you must imagine it works like this. We know we do VR, so we know that we have to render for the left and for the right eye. We need to render two views. So we will need to know where the user currently is in the virtual world. That comes from the tracking system. We know the current view direction. That also comes from the tracking system. Yeah, so that gives us the information for the look at function, for the view matrix. And then we also need a projection matrix. Yeah, and the projection matrix now really depends on the device, how are the lenses built in, and so on. And we need this undistortion function. So let's say these parameters K2 and K3 are available, so we know that function. So we render our scene and we know, yeah, that we want to do that undistortion. So one possibility would be that for all the vertices in our scene, yeah, we project them to the screen and then we apply this distortion function to the vertices directly. Yeah, so we distort our scene, yeah, so that after looking at it through the lens, it's at the right position still. That works, yeah. The computational effort is minor, yeah. It's converting to polar coordinates and applying that simple polynomial is essentially for free. It's just compute, yeah. It's nothing costly. But there's one problem, and that is that the distorted triangles or the undistorted triangles essentially, we should end up with something like this barrel distortion. Yeah, and if we now have large triangles, obviously the edges of these triangles should also be bent slightly. Yeah, well, that's probably not right, but you see what I mean. Yeah, so also the edges of the triangles should be bent. But if we only apply the undistortion to the vertices, the rasterizer in the end still generates triangles with straight edges. Yeah, and after looking at these through the lens, yeah, then the edges are bent. So this is a general problem. Yeah, we cannot directly rasterize triangles with bent edges. Yeah, they always have straight edges. That's what the rasterizer assumes. But nevertheless, this works as long as the triangles are small enough. Yeah, so if we only have small triangles, that doesn't play a role. Yeah, so if we can exclude large triangles, we are fine. Nevertheless, for a more general solution, and this is what is done in practice normally, is that this distortion or undistortion is made in an extra pass, yeah, which is a little bit more expensive, but also doable. And this works roughly like this. So first of all, we render our scene as we want that the user sees it. Yeah. So ignoring all the lens, we just render what we want to show to the user. We render this into a texture. And then we make another pass, yeah, where we take this texture and then render onto our screen a quad or a square that covers the entire screen, Yeah, so this is the entire, yeah, let's say left screen, yeah, for the left eye. And then for each of these pixels here, yeah, we call a fragment shader. And that fragment shader takes these distortion formulas and computes the corresponding position in the original view, yeah, and copies that to here. So every pixel, yeah, applies this distortion function and maps or writes the corresponding color back here. So here we get then a distorted image, yeah, which when shown on the display results in exactly that image seen by the user. Okay, yeah, that's a second render pass. I mean, I told you that performance is very critical. Yeah, it should be as fast as possible, in particular with these headsets. So having such an extra pass is some price, but latest GPUs usually can do that, yeah, so fast that it's not really a big problem. Okay, good. And in fact, yeah, usually when writing applications for these devices, SDKs are used, yeah, development kits that have all these steps already built in. So normally you render an undistorted view and give it to the SDK, and then it does all this undistortion and so forth without that we have to worry about that. Okay, that brings me to the next point, stereo rendering. Yeah. So up to now, to generate our viewing matrix, yeah, we ask the tracking device, so where's the user standing right now, what is the view direction, so this gives us the view matrix, but we still need the projection matrix. Yeah. So how do we have to display the world now on our screens here, yeah, so that the user thinks he or she is really in that virtual environment. And now obviously, yeah, we have two eyes, which are at slightly different positions, so we have to render from slightly different viewpoints. Yeah? And that means for the head-mounted display, yeah, we do not only need the position of the display, but we need the position of the eyes. Yeah? And to this end, we need to know the distance of the eyes of the user, which varies obviously from person to person. And this is a parameter that has to be set manually. Normally it's set to something like 7 centimeters, which works for most people, but it can be adapted. Yeah, and sometimes people feel better if this interpupillary distance is changed. Another point that maybe people don't think of in the very beginning is that even if I know the position of the head-mounted display and I turn my head like this, yeah, for instance, to go underwater, then obviously, yeah, the distance, yeah, does count in this direction and no longer in this direction, yeah. So all this stuff needs to be considered. Okay, so now we know the real 3D positions of our eyes. We know how to undistort the image, yeah. So we now have to find out from these two eyes how do we render, or what are the right matrices to do our projection. And yeah, this is called stereo rendering. Yeah, I will come back to how these matrices are computed in a minute. If we do that properly, we have slightly different images. Yeah, and so you see here an example with these two bunnies. At first sight, they look very similar, but if you look very close, then you see that they are from slightly different perspectives. So in fact, it's really difficult to find out the difference here. Yeah, but for the human eye, it makes a difference, and it results in that we perceive depth. Yeah, because these slightly different images lead to depth perception. But this is not the only cue to compute depth, yeah, that we have slightly different images, because people, or even if you close one of your eyes, you can still perceive depth. Yeah, so it's definitely not the only depth cue. It's an important one, but not the only one. And in fact, we can enumerate quite a few of ways to generate depth. So here we see a few examples. A very obvious one is that objects in the distance get smaller. Yeah, so smaller objects tend to be perceived as far further away. I mean, for squares, that doesn't really make sense, but for people, yeah, we know how tall people usually are. Yeah, so if they are small, in my view, obviously they're far away. Yeah, that's very primitive. And on such a HMD, if we use perspective, yeah, then we get it automatically. Another effect is that very distant objects, yeah, have these atmospheric effects so that they get blurrish and a little bit foggy. Yeah, so in VR, usually we don't have these large distances that plays a role. Or also shading, yeah, gives us hints about shape and thus about depth. Or shadows, yeah, that tell us the relative position of objects. Yeah, so these shadows clearly tell us how far above these spheres are with respect to the ground. So these are all effects, yeah, that if we do good computer graphics, yeah, then all these effects automatically come. But there's another important effect, and this is motion parallax. And this is just the effect that if I move my head slightly, yeah, then also objects in my view move slightly, and closer objects move faster than distant objects. Yeah, and this is a subtle effect. Yeah, even if I'm standing still, usually my head moves slightly, so this can also be perceived. And in VR, we also get that if we have a good, reliable, and fast tracking device. Yeah, but motion parallax very important, in particular. Yeah, if you close one of your eyes and you move your head, you still perceive depth very well. And then there's another effect, and this is focus. The human eye also has a lens, and this lens can accommodate to different depths. Yeah, so if I look at something very close, then obviously everything in the background, which is out of focus, gets unsharp. Yeah, so the eye has to accommodate to the depth of an object that we're looking at. And of course, that's also a depth cue. Yeah, if I accommodate to that object, yeah, and I use only one eye, yeah, the eye changes the shape of the lens so that we see that object sharp. Yeah, and by measuring how far I had to change the lens in my eye, I know how far that object probably is away. Yeah. So also this accommodation is a depth cue. And now, in fact, this is a problem, yeah, because I said all the other effects here can be represented in VR, yeah, motion parallax, color, and so forth. All that can be represented, but focus not. And now here the problem is that in these head-mounted displays, the display is about 10 centimeters away from the eyes, and we have these lenses. And I also said that one of the purpose of the lenses is to put the display virtually so far away from the viewer that we can accommodate to these displays, yeah, so that that the lenses in our eyes are able to focus onto that display. They wouldn't be if it would be here, but these lenses, yeah, due to the lenses, the focus is moved so that the display is about 2 meters away. But now we have a problem, yeah? That means our accommodation always is at these 2 meters, yeah? We always fixate to 2 meters, but the objects that we see, yeah, can be very close, maybe closer than a meter, or very far away. Yeah, so in terms of stereo parallax, yeah, or motion parallax, yeah, the distances vary as we want, but the focus is always at 2 meters, yeah, and it cannot be changed. I mean, we would have to exchange lenses to change the focus, yeah, and even if we could make something like zoom lenses, but then we can only globally change the focus for the entire image, yeah, but not for particular objects in our scene. Okay, so that's a problem. And it's probably also one of the reasons why many people still suffer from sickness when they wear these glasses, yeah, just because accommodation and stereo parallax don't fit together. Okay, I will also briefly come back to that again. Okay, so that's depth cues, yeah, that we have, but what we want to look at now is this stereo parallax, yeah, that we have slightly offset eyes to look at these images, and that by showing slightly different images to both eyes, yeah, we can perceive depth. Is very well known, yeah, and very early people found that out. And maybe you know some of these toys. Yeah, when I was a child, they were very popular, stuff like that. Yeah, that you could look at images, yeah, for left and right eyes slightly different, and then things looked 3D. Yeah, also older devices in that form have been presented using mirrors, maybe, yeah, to separate the image for the two eyes. About 10 or 15 years ago, were very popular stereo TVs, and also in cinemas. I mean, yeah, from time to time, or the cinemas are still, you can still see such films, such stereo films. So here the idea is that the image for the left and for the right eye are both shown on the same screen, and then special glasses are needed that separate these two images, yeah, so that the left eye sees something different than the right eye. And there are different technologies available to do that. One are so-called shutter glasses. And here the idea is that these glasses can be made blind very quickly, yeah, just by applying some current. And this allows to always close, yeah, so virtually close one eye very quickly, yeah, and then the screen always shows changing the image for the left and for the right eye, and the corresponding glass is made blind or blocked, yeah, so that you always only see one of these images, and so you can generate different images for the two eyes. It just means that your TV needs twice the image frequency, yeah, because of course you need 120 hertz to, for one eye, have 60 hertz. And these glasses need to be synchronized with the TV, so there needs to be some connection, usually some infrared signal that tells the glasses which eye is currently active and which one not. Another variant, that's what is most often used in cinemas, are polarization filters. So I already briefly, when we spoke about Fresnel, about the Fresnel term, I spoke about polarization. Here the idea is that light is an electromagnetic wave, yeah, and the magnetic and the electric field vectors are always perpendicular to each other and perpendicular to the travel direction of light. And if you look at that, it is clear that obviously, yeah, these vectors can rotate around the propagation direction. Yeah? And we are not aware of this effect because the human eye is not sensitive to that. Yeah? This photon and this photon look absolutely the same for the human eye, but at least it's possible to build filters, yeah, that block light that has the wrong direction, yeah, so that such a photon is blocked and such a photon gets through. And this is used also in photography, for instance, because sunlight usually is polarized, yeah, so we can not really block, but at least dim sunlight with such filters, and we can use that for such a polarization system by, for instance, using or by projecting two images onto a screen with a projector like that one. But we take two different projectors, we apply such polarization filters in front of the projectors with perpendicular direction. Yeah, so the photons that come out of here have this orientation, yeah, and those that come out from here have this orientation, And by using corresponding glasses, yeah, that block light that has the wrong polarization, we can again separate the two images. Yeah, so the right eye only sees the one of the right projector and the left eye from the left projector. This requires a screen that during reflection does not change polarization, which is a problem, yeah, because these are expensive screens. They need silver coatings and so forth. So a normal white wall wouldn't work. But the glasses are very cheap, and they don't require synchronization with the projectors. Yeah, so that's why this is the technology that is very often used. Or another, yeah, here you can see such a setup. Yeah, what we see here is a big projection wall. Yeah, and it's projected. The projection is from the back. So it's semi-transparent, yeah, the projectors project from the back. In fact, they project via a mirror just because it requires less space then, yeah. Both projectors have such polarization filters in front, and the user stands in front of that screen and also has such glasses and then sees separate images or sees, yeah, the image of that projector with the left eye and of that one with the right eye. Yeah, that's rather simple principle. Another technique is a little bit more sophisticated, but doesn't require so expensive screens. And these are so-called Infitech glasses. And here the idea is the following. We already briefly spoke about frequencies, light frequencies. Yeah, and visible light is in a range from 400 to 700 nanometers wavelengths, yeah? And now, for instance, what we can do is the following, that we say our projector 1, if our projector 1 displays red, it displays red here in a rather small frequency band. And this is by an observer simply observed as red. Yeah, we only have three channels of colors. Yeah, so we are not very sensitive to slight changes in frequency. Yeah, so the user sees red. And the other projector takes maybe this frequency band, yeah, so separate, and the viewer also sees red. Yeah, the viewer cannot distinguish these two reds. Yeah, it's slightly different tones of red, but they are chosen such that the red sensors in the human eye cannot distinguish between them or see them as the same red. And now the viewer has to wear glasses, yeah, and the glasses for the left eye, they have a filter that just filters out for the left eye, filters out the red frequencies for the red one, and for the red eye, filters out the frequencies for the right one. Yeah, this is not very cheap. Yeah, these polarization filters are very cheap, or rather cheap, but these filters, yeah, because they need to be very precise, yeah, and very narrow banded, they are much more complicated. But it works, and of course, not only for red, but also for green and blue. Exactly the same idea can be applied. These filters are rather expensive, so one pair of such glasses costs about 100 euros. But the advantage now is that this doesn't require such an expensive screen, yeah, that keeps polarization. I mean, polarization is not used. And in general, it delivered better quality. Yeah, so polarization glasses have another very nice property. For instance, if you rotate your head like this, yeah, then obviously you also rotate your polarization filters. So in that phase, suddenly it flips. Yeah, with the left eye, you see the right image, and with the right eye, the left image. And all these problems don't appear here. Yeah. Okay, good. So, yeah, that was sort of ancient technology. Yeah, but now we have these HMDs. Yeah, and here we can, if we look at the geometry of that setup, we always have something like this. We have here our screen, and this is separated into left screen and a right screen. Yeah. And here we have our two eyes. I removed the lenses now, yeah, because assuming, yeah, we assume that we do all this undistortion correctly, yeah. So yeah, this is kind of virtual eye position, which is probably a little bit further behind than it is in reality, yeah. But let's say all this is calibrated, yeah. So the lens stuff is done. Okay. So now here we have our two eyes, yeah, we have these two screens, and now we look into our world and you see, obviously these are the view thruster, we spoke about that. Yeah, so these are the thruster that look into the world, and because now our camera is really positioned in 3D space, we know the 3D position of that eye point and of that eye point, and we can build the according view matrices, yeah, but how do now these two images differ? Yeah, for the left and for the right. And the yeah, really old solution in former times was that we said, okay, we take two virtual cameras 7 centimeters apart and render our scenes from these two slightly offset positions and turn the cameras slightly inward. Okay, sorry, now the okay, turn the camera slightly inward, yeah, and this gives us stereo rendering. And that sort of works, but not very good. And the reason can be seen here, yeah. So let's say now we take two view thruster, yeah, and we say, okay, this is I1, this is I2. Let's say I look at a particular object. So I rotate these two cameras, yeah, so that they here the center rays coincide here at the object. Then we have these image planes, yeah, but obviously these image planes don't coincide with our screen, yeah. Our screen, maybe you remember that image I said, yeah, we can imagine I take a glass plate in front of me and then I mark every point on this glass plate with a color I see through it, and then I can take away and have a copy of that image. Yeah, and that assumes that the image plane in that case is the screen, yeah, is really perpendicular to my view direction. Yeah. And if I turn the cameras a little bit inside, these image planes are also rotated slightly, yeah? So they don't coincide with our glass plate. It would be like if my glass plate would be slightly rotated. And the result is that, for instance, for two cubes, yeah, we get something like this, which is wrong. These sides should all be parallel in reality, in a real setup, yeah? This is what geometry would tell us, yeah? But yeah, due to this incorrection of just turning a little bit, such slight projection artifacts appear. They are not severe, but they are there, and they can be solved quite easily, yeah? If you're interested in more of that, there's this link here, good stereo versus bad stereo. And the real solution is to use a sheared or skewed view thruster. That means the following. In this glass plate example, I always assume that the glass plate is perpendicular to my view direction. Yeah. So now in our setup, this is our image plane. Yeah. And due to construction, the eye is not directly at the center of that half screen. Yeah. It's usually a little bit offset. Yeah, to the outwards or maybe inwards, yeah, that depends on the device, yeah, but it's not, in general, not at the middle of that display, and thus our view thruster should look like this, yeah, our view direction should always be perpendicular to the image plane, like this here, so the view directions are parallel, not like here, turned inwards, yeah, but they should be parallel, which also makes perfect sense, yeah, because that to decide for how much we should turn, I have to decide about here such a focus plane, yeah, which, I mean, It shouldn't depend on where I look at, how the projection looks like. So the view direction is always perpendicular to our screen. So it's perpendicular, but the view frustum now obviously is no longer symmetric with respect to that. It is in this direction, it goes further, and in this direction it goes further than in these other directions. And this is the correct geometry now to describe a mapping. We have here the eye point, here's our screen. This is where our image, let's say, is projected. And if I now have that point, it's projected towards the eye. And if we define our screen as the virtual image plane, then end points automatically end up at the right position. It's exactly, we just need to align our virtual image plane and the real screen, and we get exactly the right view. And this is only possible if we use such skewed view thruster, such asymmetric view thruster. And maybe you remember we had that perspective call to set up matrices. And it, for instance, requires a field of view. And this always assumes that the field of view is symmetric, that it goes upwards as much as downwards. So we computed the tangents of half of the field of view, for instance. That all assumes that our view frustum is symmetric. So we may not use that one, but we have to use a more general function to set up our view frustum, and this is called GL frustum. I also spoke about that. And there we can set up the left and right and top and bottom windows separately. And if you look at that image, that's now exactly our setup. We say our near plane is the display, and we look perpendicular to the display, view direction is perpendicular to the display, and then the window here, left, right, bottom, top, just tells us how the display is positioned within the head-mounted glasses. And then we have to set up these asymmetric view thruster, and we get exactly the right projection that projects everything at the right place, and we automatically get these slightly offset images. And of course, now again, these parameters, left, right, top, bottom, and so forth, they depend on the device. They are usually measured after this device has been produced and then are stored in a setup file. And all these corrections usually automatically happen by the SDK. So we don't have to worry about that. Just the SDK is asked for the projection matrix for the left eye, for instance, and then the left image can be rendered, and for the right eye, and the right image can be rendered. And these matrices are delivered, but there's quite some effort behind delivering the right matrices. Okay, good. So that's how stereo rendering works. And of course, there are a few problems. So one is that our field of view is usually rather small, and in particular, also for looking inwards, with the right eye looking towards the left, and for the left eye looking to the right, that's also required because the screens for the left and for the right eye may not overlap, so there must be a clear boundary between. And as a result, it can happen that here, for instance, in that example, we have that region of a boat, which is visible for that eye, but not for that eye. It's like there is a kind of black barrier here in between, and if you try that out, that's really annoying. But it looks cool. This part here is missing, and it's in particular for objects which are nearby. So this is one problem, but it's a sort of technical optical problem. It's difficult to solve that, maybe by using stronger lenses or whatever. And another problem is what I already mentioned before, and this is that the stereo parallax, yeah, these slightly different images and the focus plane very often don't fit together. This we can see here. Yeah, so let's say we have this object that we are looking at, yeah, with these are our two eyes. So we see with this eye the image is here, with this eye the image is here, but yeah, due to the stereo parallax, the eye or the brain thinks the object is here, but the display is at a larger distance, is at 2 meters away. Yeah, so the accommodation of our eyes is at 2 meters and the object is at 1 meter. And this is something the brain might have problems with. Yeah, it's conflicting information. Very often a brain reacts to things like this, that experience says if this happens, the user has eaten something wrong or drunk something wrong and throws up, yeah, as a result. And this is not what we want. But in that case, at least for this conflict, it's for now not avoidable. Yeah, because we cannot change the focus depth as we wish. And this is the so-called vergence accommodation conflict. Yeah, vergence is usually the process that the eyes also rotate a little bit depending on which objects we look at. So if we have an object 1 meter close, yeah, then the eyes turn a little bit inward. And this also happens under the HMD. But at the same time, the accommodation, yeah, has to is for a larger distance, and these are two things that cannot be brought together, and that result in discomfort. And to sort of describe that, of course, many experiments have been made. Yeah, and you can now say, okay, definitely, yeah, in some range that's acceptable, and then maybe thresholds can be defined where usually people feel discomfort. That can all be described. So the range where focus and vergence fit together is called the so-called horopter. Yeah, it's a sort of 3D plane. And with some tolerance, the panum region can be defined. That's the range where usually this difference is not noticeable, yeah, and where no discomfort appears. And I mean, essentially, the only solution one can try is to say, I try to put all my objects into the panum region. Yeah. So this also explains why, for instance, these headsets vary in the focus distance that they provide. If you want to use that, for instance, for virtual training of things that you usually do with your hands, yeah, then it's important that the focus region is rather close. Yeah, so that the region where the device is usually used, yeah, has the right focus distance. If you use it for shooting games, then probably this distance is further away, yeah, because you're mainly looking at more distant things. But that's essentially the only thing you can do, yeah, to try to put things in a range for which there is still comfort. And I mean, other people don't have problems with that at all. Probably there's also people get used to it. Yeah, I mean, but you can also get used to it. There is still, there's a lot of research going on how to solve that problem. I will come back to that in the end when I look at remaining problems. Okay. Good. So much for stereo rendering. I mean, yeah, that probably sounds too negative. Yeah. That works, and we have nice depth perception. Often after an hour or so, people feel uncomfort. Yeah, and usually you don't want to wear that for an entire working day, for instance. And there will be more research needed. Yeah, so that this can really be worn also for a long time. Okay. One further short remark about augmented reality headsets. Yeah, we're speaking about head-mounted displays, and of course now also these transparent displays are head-mounted displays. At first sight, the only difference is that the display is transparent. We can also see our surrounding. This usually happens or is technically made by using semi-transparent mirrors. So here we can see one such system where we here have the eye, and then in front of the eye, the glass consists of such a prism. Yeah, and this is a semi-transparent mirror, and that one. And so the display is here above with some lens, and then from the display, the eye is reflected at this mirror, and then at this mirror, and then it goes to the eye. Yeah, so it requires two reflections, which means that alone with these semi-transparent mirrors, quite some light gets lost. Yeah, and it's always a problem that in augmented reality, the virtual content is not bright enough, in particular if you go outside. Yeah, probably that was also one of the problems with Google Glasses, that it's technically not possible to generate an image that is bright enough that you can use it outdoors. Yeah, and okay, but nevertheless, yeah, let's say here in a room, that's still fine. And then we have an augmented reality device. Yeah, and we can now use virtual content to augment, that's where the name comes from, our virtual world around us. And of course, we need the tracking as we have for an HMD, and all that stuff is essentially exactly the same. And here I can show a little example. I tried to show the HoloLens in lectures, I think, 3 times, and I never made it because it's very difficult, that setup, very fragile. You have to open a hotspot and stuff like that, and need several accounts and so forth. So instead, I made that little video. So that video shows the real environment. I mean, it shows the view of a user. Yeah. And it shows the real environment, and it shows the virtual content that is blended on top. And because it also has a tracking, yeah, the objects are rendered in 3D, so the 3D objects really seem to be part of the environment. At least they are localized in the environment. They are at a fixed position. Yeah, and when I turn my head, it really looks like the object is standing in front of me. And here we can see that, we can position windows or menus and then select things, and the menus can be placed somewhere on a wall, for instance. And now in this example, we can select objects, yeah, and position these objects in the scene. For instance, place that helmet onto the desk. Yeah, and when I walk around, it really looks like this helmet is on top of the desk. Maybe at this point, already the remark. Of course, in reality, this virtual image is only blended or drawn on top of the real world. That means in the real setup, behind the helmet, I can still see the desk. Yeah, because it's just blended over. And this display cannot be made opaque, yeah, so that virtual content really covers, yeah, or occludes objects from the real world. There are a few displays around that can also do that, but that's technically very challenging. Yeah, these normal displays just blend over, and this is a kind of virtual rendering. The normal video or a video of the headset is taken, and the virtual content is then rendered on top, yeah, to make that video. So here, this effect is not visible. This is not filmed through the glass, yeah, but it's kind of virtually composed. So it probably here looks better than in reality, but the effect definitely is there. And of course, now I can change the size of these objects and position new ones. For instance, here, a space shuttle. Yeah, and it's so I can augment my world with virtual objects. Yeah, and the typical application would be or the typical example that is always shown, yeah, I'm wearing such glasses, standing in front of a machine, and now the headset displays which buttons of that machine I can use. It shows arrows and so on, yeah, press this button and so forth, yeah, or open this door. And this is just blended in by these glasses. Okay, good. So, I mean, essentially, if we look at that, yeah, this looks like normal virtual reality. It's just a different display device. But in fact, there are a few special challenges for these augmented reality headsets. The first one, I already said so, the virtual image is only blended over. Yeah, so we don't have opaque objects. And it's always also the other way around. Yeah, I have to be careful here. If I take one of these objects and move them away, at some point they should disappear behind the real wall. Yeah, but that means I need to know that there's a real wall. To make occlusions correctly, I need to know a 3D model of my environment. And this means these devices also have 3D scanners built in that always generate a 3D model of the world around, yeah, that continuously is adapted while viewers are looking around. And with that, it's also possible, yeah, then to have proper occlusion so that an object, if I move it further away, at some point disappears behind the wall. Okay, so that's much more challenging, yeah? For a virtual reality headset, I don't need that. Tracking for augmented reality is very important because fast tracking and a good tracking, because in augmented reality, if the tracking is too slow or is not correct, you immediately recognize it because then the objects sort of swim with respect to the real environment, yeah? So a proper tracking of the headset is very important in augmented reality. Then virtual content and real world should fit together, so they should have a similar lighting. The ideal thing would be that I take such a virtual object, the helmet for instance, yeah, and if there's a bright light source on the right, yeah, then this should also reflect on the virtual object. Yeah, this is something that in these demos is not the case. Yeah, the helmet, if you put it in a dark room or in a bright room or with red light or with green light, the helmet always looks the same. And this vergence accommodation conflict in augmented reality is much more a problem than it is in virtual reality. And the reason is very simple. Yeah, so let's assume, yeah, our augmented reality headset has a focus distance of 2 meters. And now I take this as a virtual object, yeah, and put it in front of me, and I have a real object at the same distance. Yeah, this is virtual, this is real. This object now has an accommodation distance of 2 meters, and this one of 50 centimeters. So if I focus on this object, that one gets blurry and unsharp, and if I focus to that one, that gets unsharp. I can never see both of these sharp. Yeah, I have to move my virtual object to 2 meters to see both sharp. And this is very annoying. Yeah, in a particular, if you have that scenario that you stand in front of a machine and you see an arrow, yeah, then it doesn't make sense that to see the arrow sharp, yeah, you have to change your lenses, yeah, or change the accommodation, and then you see the arrow sharp, but the rest of the machine gets blurry. And if you see the machine sharp, the arrow gets blurry. So in augmented reality, this conflict becomes very, very quickly visible. And, there is also one, or recently, one reality headset has been presented, Magic Leap, startup company, and they promised that they solved this vergence accommodation conflict for augmented reality. They promised a lot, but it only worked sort of. And I don't know whether this company still exists, but it was not too successful. Essentially, this is an unsolved problem. Okay, good. Good. So this brings me to challenges. Yeah, what is still to be done? Isn't everything solved? Definitely not. Yeah. So this entire concept is really only at the very beginning. And it has very good reasons that it's not yet really used in practice, in working environments or whatever. It's mainly a gaming device, I would say. And even gamers at some point say, okay, I mean, it's cool at the beginning, yeah, but after some time, I prefer to play on my screen, yeah, where things are smoother and sharper and so forth. But nevertheless, things advance. So there are still challenges, tracking, yeah, finding out the positions that should be very fast. It should be comfortable, yeah, so not heavy, ideally, yeah, with no direct devices, mechanical devices or something like that, and easy to build up. So we will speak about it next week. Yeah? So for instance, this device here, you see it just needs to be positioned somewhere. It doesn't need to be calibrated, or calibration is very fast at least. Yeah, and then we get a rather good tracking. But nevertheless, yeah, this only also works in a rather small scale. If we want to walk around in buildings, in entire buildings or factories or museums or so, then there's no tracking system available that works at a precision how it is needed for virtual reality. Yeah, so it's a largely unsolved problem. Okay, next week we will speak about how at least the state of the art works. Low latency, that's something I didn't speak about yet. I mentioned it, yeah, but we will look into details also next week. The time to photon, that's how it's called, should be as small as possible. And what is meant is, if I rotate my head slightly, yeah, this movement should reflect on the screen as fast as possible. There are experiments that say that it should be in the range of 1 millisecond, yeah. And now you might say, okay, 1 millisecond, that would mean I need a screen with 1,000 hertz, yeah, which is very much, yeah, much more than displays today have. But in fact, it's not only the refresh rate of the display, there are many other things, or several others, yeah. So for instance, an image has to be transmitted from the computer to the display, yeah. Alone that already takes more time. Sensors have some time, require some time to measure position and so on. So it's many effects that add up to this latency. It's not only having a high refresh rate. Yeah? And it can also be, algorithms can be used that minimize this time or that reduce this time. This we will also speak about next week. And the virtual accommodation conflict, largely unsolved. That will be really a challenge for the next 10, 20 years, I would say. Many people are building such devices, yeah, which sometimes are enormously big. Yeah, so they are far away from being wearable. Yeah, so you can place your head on a rest, yeah, and see the effect. But it's by far not wearable. And it's, yeah, for various reasons will be a very difficult problem. And still a solution, yeah, is definitely lacking. Okay, so this is what I wanted to tell you today. We will speak about tracking and low latency next week, but not on Monday. On Monday, Frank Bauer, who is a postdoc in my group, and he knows Unity, the Unity engine or Unity scene graph very well. And he will give an introduction to Unity. And this will be on Monday. And on Thursday, we will then speak about these issues of head-mounted displays. And if somebody wants to try our Roman boat demo, then please come down and you can make a try and see it live. Okay, thank you. See you next.